This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This is another podcast of Worldwide Wave, the international LGBT news and current affairs show, every week on Australia's first LGBT radio station, Joy 94.9.
As an economist, what motivated you to focus on LGBT equality? Because I know it wasn't just that you started with a book. You'd obviously been doing this for a long time before that.
I started studying LGBT inequality when I started seeing things in kind of the business press about what a dream market LGBT people were, or lesbian and gay people back then in the 90s. There were claims being made that that lesbians and gay men were high income, high education, sort of brand pioneers, early adopters of new technologies, all these different things that companies look for, that they have nice homes and fancy cars and go on great vacations. So these are all, you know, kind of the LGBT people were a business demographic, a marketing demographic. And that did not make any sense to me, frankly. I had started out in my career studying race and sex discrimination. And what we learned is when you face discrimination, you actually have lower incomes and less stuff, less wealth, not more. So it didn't make sense from that perspective. And as a lesbian, I knew lots of lesbians and gay men, and I just wasn't seeing that, you know, that marketer's dream playing itself out there amongst the people that I knew. So I was puzzled, and, you know, if you're an academic, you love a good puzzle like that. And so I looked hard at the marketing data and found that it was very skewed towards people who have high incomes. So like people who would read newspapers or were in organizations or had certain credit cards. All these are just high income people. And I also found better data that showed a very different kind of picture. So the picture that the data really showed was that gay men and bisexual men actually earn less than similar heterosexual men, not more. Lesbian and bisexual women do earn more than heterosexual women, but that's because heterosexual women are pretty much at the bottom of the economic ladder in terms of earnings anyway. And lesbians and bisexual women still earn less than men, whether they're gay or straight. So there's really no evidence for that idea that somehow gay people are an affluent elite group of people who, and that was used to justify all sorts of inattention to big public policy issues in the US. Opponents would say, this is a group that's not does not need our policy attention. They don't need the help of courts or of Congress to seek equality because they're doing just fine without it. So, you know, so that was the argument that kind of pulled me in to trying to study inequality.
How does economic equality for LGBT people help the community, like, as a whole?
Well, it happens in different ways. So if you think about the, you know, those losses from education, the losses that happen when we allow discrimination against LGBT people in the workforce, that pulls them out of places where they'll be most productive and able to use those skills, knowledge, and creativity that they can bring to the labor force. So we're going to lose out there. There's a bad cycle that develops also related to health, where discrimination in different contexts, including education and the workforce, will have feedback effects on health because learning that you might be a target of discrimination can be bad for your health in many ways. Sometimes it's literally bad for your health if you face violence, but it can also happen if you start to worry about the fact that you might be discriminated against in certain settings and you start taking actions to try to protect yourself. And one thing that very commonly happens is that people just try to hide the fact that they are LGBT. And by not disclosing that, it means a couple of things. There's some evidence that suggests that's bad for your health in and of itself, but it also means that it's harder to get the kind of social supports that might be helpful for living in a more discriminatory society. So there's all sorts of ways that that health gets implicated. Those are some examples. And we know there are many, many studies in lots of different countries that show health disparities for LGBT people. So there's higher rates of anxiety and depression, higher rates of substance use, higher rates of suicidal thinking, of HIV, of violence, all of these kinds of health issues link up the discrimination across these different settings. And so if you take all those together, what you see is just kind of this shift away for LGBT people, pulling them away from the places where they can be most productive and probably happiest in terms of contributing to the economy. If you try to add it all up, which I've done a couple of times, and some other researchers have tried to do this, it actually it's a meaningful number. So even just looking at a few of these differences that we know about and have pretty good data on, like employment discrimination, like health differences, so not even getting to education, but even just health and employment, it adds up somewhere on the order of about 1% of a nation's economy. And, 1% is a fairly small number. It doesn't look like it's very big or important. But, you know, if we see a drop in our gross domestic product, GDP, which is how we measure economic output most of the time, if we saw that drop, we would call that a recession. Right now, we're facing a much, much more deeper global recession than that. But this 1% for homophobia and transphobia is kind of like a permanent recession. It's saying, you know, we're always producing less than we could. And frankly, if you were to add in, the same kinds of effects for women, for different racial and minority groups, for indigenous peoples, we would see that similar pulling back of kind of keeping our economy away from producing at its most effective. So it can it's a large and meaningful effect. In fact, if you thought about it on a global level, if you said, what's 1% of everything that gets produced in the whole world, what we're looking at is something that's about the size of the whole economy of the Netherlands or the whole economy of Turkey. You know, these are not teeny tiny little countries. These are big, important countries. And so that 1% can be a really important part of our economy.
You write in the book about LGBT inclusive schooling. How important is that to make sure that it's safe for kids to attend when they're LGBT?
Yeah, education is an essential economic institution. You know, education is important for lots of reasons, but, you know, one of the reasons is because people learn things there that are important for their lives later on when they're in the labor market. And economists know that the level of education that people have is an important predictor of economic outcomes. So, and determinant really of economic outcomes. So it's important to know how well LGBT people are doing in schools. And what we find, there's research all over the world that shows that LGBT young people face really challenging situations. They face bullying in the schools from their fellow students. They might face discrimination from teachers and from, you know, even just the policies of a school. Dress codes, for example, might make it harder for LGBT young people to have a good school experience. So where they are able to learn, you know, what they're supposed to learn, not that they're targets, but that they are, you know, they're learning math, they're learning how to write, they're learning how to think critically. So all the important skills are really what we want people to get. But the problem is that bullying holds people back. It has, obviously, can have devastating psychological consequences to young people who are bullied. But beyond that, I mean, it gets worse. They're going to school in environments that are not conducive to learning. So at least a few countries that have data to look at this have shown that grade point averages are lower for LGBT kids who are bullied. They're less likely to attend school. They're more likely to drop out. They're less likely to continue on to university. So there are lots of consequences to bullying for the LGBT young people themselves. But it's actually also likely to be harmful for kids who may not ever think of themselves as LGBT, but who are seen as maybe not conforming to the expectations of how girls are supposed to act or boys are supposed to act in schools. So they get punished for their gender nonconformity. So that's a piece of it as well. So this is all kind of really very much the same thing. So those are hitting young people who are not LGBT. We also know just from research on bullying in general that schools that have a lot of bullying are just not good places for students to learn. They show that schools that have a lot of bullying are places where the average test scores might be lower. So everybody is harmed by that lack of schooling. The bullying in schooling, it generates, you know, just poor educational outcomes. So that means that young people are going into the labor market kind of less well prepared than they should be. And that's not a good thing for our economies.
What happens if we kind of just let these issues of LGBT equality, like economically, go unaddressed?
Well, I don't think they're ever going to really go unaddressed completely. I mean, if we were to just sort of let them go, I mean, they would fester. They would keep our economy held back. They would probably, you know, generate other dynamics that will enhance that. So, for example, you know, if you make getting an education more unpleasant for people and don't address that, then people are going to start expecting to have certain kinds of bad experiences at school, and they're just not going to go on as much as they could. But really, LGBT people and organizations have been fighting against these effects for many decades. And so it's never really going to go completely unaddressed in that sense. We have fought back and resisted that kind of treatment, and I think that's very important. So we see all over the world organizations of LGBT people who are making the case that, you know, discrimination in schools is a bad thing, or in the workplace or in healthcare settings. So there's a lot of effort from the community that's there to deal with that. And some of it is advocacy, you know, advocating for policies, but some of it is just kind of building supports for people so that they have a way to understand what's happening to them and to say it's not because you're a bad person that you lost your job, but because we have homophobia in our society or transphobia that makes employers not want to hire you, just as an example. So just having that analysis, psychologists have told us, you know, matters in terms of how people look at it and can have its own effect. But also just social support. You know, one of the reasons why we have these, I mean, I guess this is the way I look at it, one of the reasons why we have these identities and kind of think about them as communities, lesbian community, gay community, or the bisexual or transgender communities, or just putting them all together, is that we need to support each other. And that kind of support can help mitigate some of the harms, certainly at least the psychological harms, but sometimes also the economic harms. What I'm doing now is trying to study ways that LGBT people and groups are trying to provide economic empowerment for people. So I think there's lots of ways that we've pushed back. And there certainly are now, you know, many, many heterosexual allies and people who've just changed their minds about LGBT issues and are, you know, it's a different world than it was, you know, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30, 40, 50 years ago. In many places, it's quite different. In the United States, it's quite different. So there, you know, in other countries, you know, bigger issues may be, you know, decriminalizing homosexuality, because I think in still 65 or so countries of the world, there's still laws that make it illegal to be LGBT. So there's lots of efforts there that are happening. I can go on about this forever. I mean, one of the reasons why I actually, some of the research that I've done that I talk about in the book, and one of the reasons why I wrote the book, are also because there is this growing global interest from bodies like the United Nations, and in particular the United Nations Development Program is a group that I've worked with some on these issues, the World Bank, which surprises some people, lots of the development banks and agencies who might not be as interested in human rights per se, but do care about economic growth and development. They're listening to this argument. And so it's, I think, you know, one of the things that the argument has about the economic case has become a tool for advocates to be able to use to talk to some of those kinds of agencies, some of those institutions.
How important is it to find the best argument, whether or not you kind of go with the human rights one or the straight economic, like, do this for the money?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. I mean, I the way I look at it is you don't have to choose. You can use both arguments. I mean, the human rights argument is very powerful and extremely important. But if you're going to go talk to a business about its policies, or the World Bank for that matter, you know, about their policies and what they're doing and could be doing, the human rights argument's not going to take you very far because those organizations are driven by different goals. So partly it's strategic, you know, sort of having a couple of options that you can frame arguments in one way for certain audiences and another way. But they're also extremely compatible. I mean, the way I think about it is putting dollar values on these harms are really just saying, you know, these human rights violations, which is what those human rights violations are costly for LGBT people. And we can actually think about it that way. We can actually try to estimate what those costs are. But there are some human rights activists who I think do feel a little bit uncomfortable with this. I think the economic case sounds so much like the business case. And the business case for companies is it will make your profits better, higher, right? So so it sounds like that. And some of them don't like other things that corporations do, or they just don't like capitalism. And so they're not so comfortable with the economic case. But I have talked to many, many activists who think that it's just an important tool for them to have.
When you were doing the research for your book, was there anything you came across that you found surprising?
You know, I did. And this will sound a little bit geeky. I mean, I have one of the projects that I've worked on over the last few years has been with the United Nations Development Program and the World Bank to create what we're calling an LGBTI inclusion index. So it would be a measure that would capture in a very detailed and nuanced way how well LGBTI people are doing in different countries of the world, and trying to get beyond to include things related to laws and policies, but also to look at just the lived experience of people. They're, you know, are they in poverty, living in poverty? Are they, what's their income level? How much education do they have? So some of those kinds of measures. And you know, it's been for some of those indicators, a very abstract kind of exercise because we just don't have very good data. This is what we kept saying. We want this measure to be in here, but we don't have good data on that in the most countries in the world. So we kind of got into this mantra of saying, there's just not enough data. There's no data. You know, sometimes it would go from not enough to no data. But in fact, there's a lot of data. So that's what surprised me when I went out and started gathering information for the book, was that data, also gathering data, turns out to be a really important tool for activists. They're doing a lot of it in many parts of the world. They're saying, we need some numbers. We need something a little more than just this person telling their story. So they may be doing surveys or other kinds of research to gather data. And so it turns out that there's quite a bit out there to draw on that show similar patterns across countries, that LGBT people face big challenges. They face discrimination, sometimes face violence, they live in communities where they face stigma. And so those things are kind of all in common. I mean, so I had a lot to draw on. I was able to talk about research from many parts of the world in the book. That said, for purposes of the LGBTI Inclusion Index, it's not the kind of data that we can compare across countries. So this is where we get super geeky. You know, so the data don't come from representative samples of LGBT people, so we can't compare the people that we, you know, survey in Australia to those in the United States maybe, or to those in Peru. So because they're just done in such different ways. So we still need better data. But we still can say a lot with the data that activists have worked very hard to create, and other kinds of organizations and academics have worked very hard to create.
There's going to be like serious economic shock from COVID-19. Is there a way that you think this will affect the LGBT community?
I do from the very beginning. And we're starting to hear a little bit about some of this. An organization called Outright International did a very important kind of quick survey early on in the epidemic. And they talked to people from many different parts of the world. So we're starting to get a little bit of a sense of what the effects are. But even before it started, I mean, if you think about the picture that I've been outlining, where people are economically vulnerable, perhaps because of issues with education or with discrimination in the labor force, and they have health disparities before all this gets started. I mean, we are talking about people who are in a tough position, right? So if you have poor health to begin with, it makes you more vulnerable. If you are economically insecure, it means you don't have the savings, the assets to help make it through what has been, for many people, an extremely challenging, very difficult time economically. I mean, all over the world, we see people facing issues with getting food. So food insecurity, being able to pay bills, it gets very hard if you start out in a bad position. So I think as we see more data come in, we are going to see that there have been challenges, and they may be worse, because one of the aspects of discrimination from many employers' perspective is the people they're going to get rid of first are the ones that they're, you know, a little not so sure that they wanted to hire in the first place. You know, so whether that's women or LGBT people, for example, they may be the first to go. So the Outright International study showed what I think is exactly these kinds of things happening. The big hit that many people took to their economic lives, especially people who are more marginalized economically to begin with. So my guess is that as we move forward on LGBT issues, we're going to spend a lot more time talking about economic vulnerability. Health has been a topic for a long time because of HIV, but we've never really centered economic vulnerability and economic inequality beyond just sort of thinking about it from as a policy matter. Discrimination is bad, let's pass a law against that. That's very important, but it's not going to necessarily bring up the economic standard of living for LGBT people.
Are there economic costs for LGBT people that are specific to the US?
There are some kinds of costs that might be specific to the US or to another country. I think, you know, the marriage equality example is a good one. Like, when public policy creates differences in access to things like social security benefits or health insurance, then you're going to see that. We have a crazy health insurance system here where it's still mostly provided by employers and provided privately, so we don't have a public system, and so it's very tied to employment. And so not being allowed to marry was a really big problem for employees who had same-sex partners and maybe children that they needed healthcare coverage for. So that was a big motivator of the push for equality in the United States was the healthcare system. And so we still think about that. I think we're still working on getting full equality in the healthcare system in the US. And that's at least partly because of our crazy system. So that's one specific example. But I think, you know, every country has countries have different approaches to dealing with things like poverty. In the US, we don't have a lot of supports for low income people. The ones that we have been kind of chipped away at by policymakers over the last few decades. So poverty is a really big problem for people in the U.S. because they're mostly left on their own to deal with it. And maybe they've got families, but for many LGBT people, family support it may not be forthcoming. And we've been interviewing low-income people in Los Angeles and in a rural county in California over the last couple of years. And we're hearing this, so people report that sometimes their family members are supportive and will, you know, buy food for them, for example, if they're food insecure. But in many cases, these folks cannot count on their families.
What is like the business case for LGBT equality?
So when LGBT people were kind of pushing back against inequality in the workplace, in many cases they would go to their employers and they would say, "You're not treating me fairly. I'm gay or I'm lesbian or bisexual or transgender. I have a same-sex partner, and this person's not eligible for benefits. Or, you know, I worry about discrimination. You know, people are calling me names, people misgender me, whatever the issues are. They push their employers to take action in ways that really are not compelled, at least here in the U.S., they're not compelled by public policy until pretty recently. So businesses have thought about these issues for a long time, for decades now. And what they now believe and what they say very publicly is that they think it's good for their businesses to be more inclusive of LGBT people. So, and they say they want to treat people equally because it makes them more productive. It makes them more loyal to the company, so they're less likely to leave. And employers don't like it when their employees leave because they have to replace them. That's costly. They have to hire a new replacement. That's costly. So it's good for them to be able to attract and retain the best employees, to have good policies for LGBT people. And it's also because sometimes that's a signal for heterosexual people, heterosexual cisgender people, to know that they're in a company that supports tolerance and diversity. So it's good really just all around from the perspective of these businesses. And in fact, actually, there's a lot of research that now suggests they're absolutely right, that that the companies that have better policies for LGBT people tend to have higher levels of profit. They have higher stock prices. And sometimes a couple of studies have shown that they have higher levels of productivity of their workers. So the research supports what businesses have been saying. But what businesses are saying is kind of what their employees told them. So I think it's an interesting cycle. It's kind of like what we had talked about a little while ago, where it's like, you know, yes, these problems exist, but there's pushback on them. You know, there are people trying to make things better.
If businesses started pushing for or saying, yeah, no, we're on board, we think that this helps our business, did that allow an easier transition for public policy to change?
Absolutely. Businesses have become big advocates for LGBT equality in different places. Just examples, you know, I know in the United States and Australia and Taiwan and Ireland, businesses were very vocal proponents of giving same-sex couples the right to marry. And in the US situation, they actually wrote and signed with their company names on them briefs to our Supreme Court, making that very case, saying they need equality, that equality is a good situation for them to do business in. So companies are saying that very publicly, increasingly. And in some cases where they're maybe not so comfortable with saying it individually, they're working on ways to say it together. So there's in the book, I talk about an interesting group called Open for Business. I'm on their research advisory board. And they are a coalition of very large multinational brands. And they are using the business case to make that case to governments and to societies where LGBT people are not treated very well, but trying to kind of make the case that it would be good for business and businesses will be more likely to invest there, that there'll be sort of better, stronger companies and employers if they are allowed to treat LGBT people. So the business case has, you know, that little offshoot of the economic case has been a very powerful tool for change already.
It's been so really, really interesting talking to you.
Great. Well, I enjoyed the conversation. Yeah. Thanks for inviting me.
Thanks for listening to another podcast from World Wide Wave, the show that takes you around the globe one country at a time. World Wide Wave is the international news and current affairs show on Australia's LGBT radio station, Joy 94.9. You can listen live every Tuesday night from 7 p.m. Eastern Australian Time on 94.9 FM in Melbourne and online at joy.org.au. You'll find all our podcasts at joy.org.au/worldwidewave or follow us on Facebook for the latest international LGBT news. Search W3 Joy on Facebook now.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.